This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. On the program today, we have a conversation with Lee Morris, Susan Duncan, who represent the League of Women Voters of the Calumet area, and Whiting Mayor Joe Stahura. They're in the studio to talk about a resolution that is working its way through the various community, city, and town councils, and even going around the state, for that matter, looking for some redistricting reform. What kind of reform is that? Well, we'll find out more in just a few. Also, too, a conversation talking about how a school in Portage has been remodeled after a deadly school shooting out of state. And we also have as well, too, the latest on how this weekend's Voices for Peace rally happened in Valparaiso. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. We have in studio three people who can fill us in more on a large statewide, actually, campaign that is underway, much of it by organizations within communities, as well as the League of Women Voters, looking statewide as well, dealing with the question of redistricting reform. There are issues that came up in recent years before the General Assembly about getting the districts in Indiana that set up whether districts are properly proportioned by political party to be in the equal sense. But the legislature's kind of set it aside, and now there's a grassroots effort that is underway with communities as well as with organizations within the various governments to see that this reform is enacted. And actually what's kind of started here in Northwest Indiana has been the resolution that several town and city councils have already passed. Some are also considering. Right now we have with us Susan Duncan, who represents the League of Women Voters of the Calumet area. She's in studio with us. Susan, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
Also with us we have Lee Morris, who has been working very hard with the communities, showing them the information about this redistricting reform and encouraging them to support the resolution. And Lee, thank you for joining us.
Great to be with you always.
And with us as well, we have Whiting Mayor Joe Stahura, who is representing one of the communities whose city council has reviewed and voted for this resolution, which in turn has put them on the list of those communities, city and town councils, who are in support of the redistricting reform. Mayor Stahura, thank you for joining us as well, too.
Glad to be here.
Lee, let's start first, if you will, explain for us. I think people may understand basically what redistricting is all about. There are official definitions, and you can go online and you can look at any number of them, almost more than you probably wish to be more confused when you look at them. But if you will, give us an idea in particular with this resolution what the redistricting reform is all about.
Well, redistricting reform is to deal with something we call gerrymandering. A lot of people have heard of that term, but what it means is the manipulation of how legislative and congressional districts are drawn so that one party or the other may be favored. And this is not anything that's exclusive to either party. It happens. It's happened through the years, and it's been a particular problem here in Indiana. As a matter of fact, the University of Chicago did a study a few years ago that indicated Indiana's districting was the fifth most partisan redistricting they've seen in their analysis. So what we're advocating is going to a nonpartisan redistricting reform so that no political party is benefited. Very specific standards for how you delineate the districts, and a structure that gets it done outside the political process. It still has to be approved by the elected officials, but the whole process is done outside of that political venue, which has resulted in the gerrymandering we have now.
Okay.
The resolution is simply a document that lays out why this is important and expresses support of a unit of government for the nonpartisan redistricting. And that's really important because although we've got a very well-structured proposal in Indiana, we've not been able to get a legislative hearing on it in the General Assembly. So we think it may be important for the legislators to hear from the people locally about how important this is and that it is something that really needs to have their attention and action.
And I suppose by the fact that all of these similar, if not the same, resolution has come up before these town and city councils here in Northwest Indiana, and these people have shown their support for this resolution, at least it gets the word out in their communities as to what this is all about.
Exactly, exactly.
Susan, how did the League of Women Voters of the Calumet area get involved in this?
Well, the League, as you know, is a voter advocacy organization, and I want to underscore what Lee just said about the analysis that indicates that Indiana is one of the worst gerrymandered, partisan gerrymandered states in the country. It also has one of the lowest voter turnouts in the country. Many experts and activists believe that the more partisan gerrymandered, the more gerrymandered districts you have, the more voters come to believe that their votes don't count for anything. And this suppresses voter turnout, and we all know what the bad consequences are of a suppressed voter turnout. So the League is in a coalition with Indiana Common Cause and about a dozen other organizations around the state to push for an independent commission to handle redistricting reform. And it's particularly important right now because the 2020 census is going to happen, and the year after that, the legislature will have to do a redistricting. And we want to have an independent commission in place before that date arrives.
I know you mentioned Indiana Common Cause, and I've seen some articles in the Indianapolis Star in recent months mentioned that the director of Indiana Common Cause, Julia Vaughn, has become sort of the face of redistricting reform. Although she's not the only face, there are a lot of other faces around Indiana, but I know she's the one that is the best known, it seems, yes. and certainly the most vocal of, I'm sure, many very vocal voices about this.
Indeed.
Mayor Stuhura, give us an example from your standpoint as the mayor of the city of Whiting, what Lee and other people who have brought this idea of redistricting reform in the form of this resolution have brought to you, that you in turn turned over to your city council, and why they have become the one of at least, now what, 25 communities in Northwest Indiana who are members of the group that has supported redistricting reform.
Yeah, I think the simple answer is that the city council has always supported good public policy, and this is really, truly good public policy. And, you know, you have to make some changes in the system we have to make it work. Almost at the same time, both Lee and Susan approached Lee contacted me, and Susan, as a resident of Whiting, contacted her city councilman. And it didn't take them long to review it and understand that it's the right thing to do and certainly something that we could support. And they took pretty quick action on it. And I appreciate them for doing that. It's they're not afraid to step up to the plate, and that's what they did.
When this all came up for discussion before the council, what did some of the council members have to say about this?
Yeah, actually, you know, the discussion was actually pretty minimal. You know, I think when they all read it, they totally understood it. And, of course, it's got a national kind of tone to the discussion. Now you see things in Pennsylvania and other states now that where there's some action going on. So they're well aware of the issues and the problems. So it was very easy for them to put it on the floor and to take a vote.
Do you think, and I'll open up the question to any of our people here in the studio to answer, do you think that in light of the fact that Northwest Indiana has unfortunately historically been known as an organization, an area with organizations that have very distinct political subdivisions and viewpoints and opinions, do you think that maybe that this particular resolution is more successful this time around than, we'll say, 20, 30 years ago, back in the days when the quote-unquote political corruption seemed to reign in Northwest Indiana?
I think you may be right, Chris, but I think also people are aware that the low voter turnout in Indiana is a very serious problem and that it's a multifaceted problem. Getting the districting done properly so that we have a better representation for people is an important ingredient in that process. 43% of the positions in our Indiana General Assembly were uncontested the last time around. And that's a really a symptom, I think, of the fact that we don't have good voter engagement. And dealing with the redistricting is a very important issue in that regard. I've looked at the six states that have the highest turnout. You know, look at Minnesota with 75% turnout. Indiana, in our primary election, we're probably going to have about 15-16%. Colorado has 72%. Wisconsin has 70%. So what I did, I looked at each one of those states and said, what have they done differently from Indiana that's enabling them to have that kind of turnout? And redistricting is one of them. Certainly, same-day voter registration is another we're going to be looking at. Vote by mail has been a major factor in a number of states where high turnouts are occurring. So Indiana doesn't have to reinvent the wheel. There are states out there that are doing a great job, and we simply need to learn from them, I believe. And that's what we're trying to help do with this.
Do you think that this, along with these other measures that you're proposing, and that many others are proposing as well, to try to boost voter turnout, this in turn will maybe make it easier to get more people interested in becoming political candidates and being involved in public office?
I think so. And, you know, I'm interested in what Susan and Joe's experience has been, but I've detected a renewed interest in engagement in the political process, particularly by young people. I think they're seeing that they don't really like what's been happening in the political process, and they know it's not going to change unless they get involved. Mm-hmm. And so that increased enthusiasm is really encouraging to me.
We mentioned just a few of the communities here in particular, in Lake and County in particular, that are involved in this redistricting reform with the resolution. There are other communities in Porter and LaPorte counties and surrounding counties as well. Just a few of these that are around Northwest Indiana. What's been the opinion of these folks that have decided to join the bandwagon, so
well,
to speak?
Well, we've had a lot of enthusiasm. I think people are recognizing that it is an important step to take, and it's probably not going to happen unless we demonstrate that support from the grassroots. I think our legislators are very sensitive when they hear input from cities and towns and counties about issues that are important, and I'm very optimistic that we'll be able to get the full consideration of this proposal in the next session of the General Assembly. We'll be able to get an actual hearing on it in the committees so that the houses and our General Assembly then have an opportunity to vote on it. And I believe there will be strong support for this. This is not a partisan issue at all, in my opinion. So,
do you think that because there are so many communities, not only locally but also across Indiana, and we're talking about communities around the state that include like South Bend and Lafayette and West Lafayette and Vincennes and Anderson and Crawfordsville and Evansville, mm-hmm. as far south as Evansville, mm-hmm. that more communities in Indiana are much more interested in this besides the ones that you would normally think of as being very politically active, like Bloomington, yes. and Muncie and places like that?
Indeed, I agree completely. We've got about 12 other cities and towns right now that are underway with consideration. Hobart was the most recent one here in this region. The town of Highland is having a study session on this tonight with their town council. But we've got about 10 others across mainly northern Indiana, because that's where I'm working right now, mm-hmm. That I hope will join this group so that we can go to the General Assembly with a high degree of support being expressed from back home.
When you say talking about being representing northern Indiana communities, how far to the east did you move out of Northwest Indiana to talk to
I'm over in Fort Wayne.
What are the folks in South Bend and Fort Wayne, what do they think about this?
South Bend is very supportive. Mm-hmm. Fort Wayne has not yet fully considered it, but we're working on it. I'm optimistic that mm-hmm. they will be, because it's a progressive city.
Now, Susan, when you had a chance with your standpoint with the League of Women Voters, you mentioned earlier about the fact that we've gotten organizations like Common Cause in Indiana involved in this and people like Julia Vaughn involved. What kind of information do you learn in contact with them as to how other communities and other places in the state are coming along in this campaign as well?
Well, Julia Vaughn is tremendously knowledgeable. She's got her finger on the pulse of all the different communities around Indiana. There's guarded optimism about the chance for a resolution to be heard in the 2019 session. Guarded mm-hmm. because we still do have a Republican supermajority, mm-hmm. and it is in the interest of the Republican Party, despite this being a nonpartisan issue, there would be an interest on the part of the Republican Party to maintain districts as they are now, or tweak them even further to assure further Republican gains in the Assembly. So there is discussion among people like Julia Vaughn and the representative of District 1, Linda Lawson, that the real challenge here is convincing enough people in the state of both parties of the value of an independent redistricting commission to convince people who representatives who are in safe districts or uncontested districts that this is just the right thing to do for the electorate. instituting redistricting reforms.
How do you think in Representative Lawson's case, since she's chosen not to run for re-election and she basically has served her last term of office in the General Assembly this past session, she is still very, very influential and very knowledgeable and has a lot of friends and a lot of influence outside of that. Do you think that now she'll be able to, if she hasn't already, going to spend more time helping push this through?
We have Linda Lawson scheduled to spend more of her time working on this issue already.
That's good. Yes. She's already committed to the time. That's good.
Right. Well, we're capitalizing on her expertise and her, get up and go.
And I know that she in the past has spoken very highly of this, but the importance of this to make sure that people are aware of this, that the problems that can come about politically as well as socially and economically from not having properly district to districts, as you wish.
I'd actually like to say something about that. The consequences are very widespread, much more so than most people who haven't given a lot of thought to this realize. The whole process is politically polarizing. If you have very partisan gerrymandered districts, what happens is that the really important elections become the primary elections where the people in opposition are all speaking to the most extreme elements of the party base. And whoever comes out of that process in a safe district is likely then to become the representative of the district as a whole. Mm-hmm. And so we end up with a more partisan, more polarized political system. And pretty much everybody agrees that doesn't work out well for anyone.
Okay. Mayor Suhura, we're going to give you the last word in the conversation for now here. And following along here, what impact do you see economically in your community of Whiting that this, in turn, the redistricting reform can benefit the citizens as well as the government office holders?
Yeah, that's a tough question. But, I mean, I just think, you know, when you enact good public policy and you can then change some of the negative aspects of the current system, that it benefits everybody throughout the region. I mean, you know, you could take a look at some of the maps, right? The gerrymandered maps, they're actually look like cartoons,
right?
They're spread across so many different districts. And like Susan says, it's not only it's discouraging to people to understand that the process it works in that way, you know. So when it's all said and done, you know, it's sticking to what's right is always works. And you know, you're always going to have a party in power at one point or another. But soon down the road, the other party will also be in power. You know, things will flip. So doing the right thing in a nonpartisan way always benefits the greater community.
That's Whiting Mayor Joe Suhura, His city council has supported this resolution that in turn supports redistricting reform to be done by the General Assembly. Also with us has been Lee Morris, who's been working very hard as a former a governmental official as well here in Northwest Indiana to see that this resolution is moving forward in the community. Communities, actually, several, now at least 25 who have signed on to this. And we also have with us Susan Duncan, who is representing the League of Women Voters of the Calumet area, who is very, very supportive, and the League of Women Voters in general, very supportive of this redistricting reform. Thank you all for joining us today. This is another conversation we'll have to keep an eye on and have you back in, I'm sure, to talk about again in more detail as soon as we find more communities that are showing their support and hopefully pressuring the General Assembly as a whole to take this up very soon. Thank you for being with us today.
Chris. Thanks, Chris.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. 3 months have passed since the deadly school shooting at Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, and the nation is yet again forced with another set of school shootings, and the most recent shooting happening in Noblesville at Noblesville West Middle School. Lakeshore Public Radio's Valerie Plenovich has this story about one local school's controversial classroom renovations.
The frequency and commonality of violent events in schools raises the concern for school safety all around the nation and here in Northwest Indiana. The question of what can we do to keep students safe at school now gets asked more and more. Portage High School recently finished a $10 million renovation of the west side of the building this past spring, and one of its many new features is glass classroom walls. The new design concept allows for more natural light and spaces where students can collaborate. But how safe are they? Darren Shine, a senior at Portage and a member of the newly formed Portage Township School Student Safety Committee, recently voiced his concerns about the glass walls.
It's not safe. It's completely glass. They said that the glass is not shatter resistant, not shatterproof, not bulletproof. If there were a code red, where can you hide? It's completely see-through.
The Times reports that Portage Township School's superintendent, Amanda Alanez, said the theme during planning was future-ready forward, with a look to digital age and personalized learning for students that will encourage them to be innovative, creative, and collaborative. What does this mean for the future of school safety protocols at Portage High School? Shine and the rest of the Student Safety Committee brought these concerns to the table at a meeting with the school board and stated that the board is working on fundraising for the installation of bulletproof glass. Shine is graduating in a matter of days, but his sister will be attending high school this fall.
I don't feel safe for her if she has to be in a classroom where there is no door, there's completely glass. That needs to be taken care of immediately.
Portage's superintendent, assistant superintendent, and members of the school board were contacted, but no comments were given. This is Valerie Plenovich, Lakeshore Public Radio.
Across the country, schools are honoring graduates at commencement ceremonies. At Franklin College, a group of students, part of a two-year program called Inspire, recently received diplomas. Indiana Public Broadcasting Lindsay Wright reports that the work-study program allows students with special needs to have a traditional college experience rather than a special one.
In Adam Heverin's exercise science class, students are learning about muscles in the hip and thigh as they head into the home stretch of the semester.
If you have weakness or if you have tightness or you have inflammation in these muscles, can really affect that sciatic nerve.
There's one student in particular who's really engaged in today's work. Emery Himes has Down syndrome, but he still participates in class discussion and keeps up on his assignments. Heverin calls Emery one of his best students.
He has a great imagination, and he comes up with things in class that our other students don't. So it's not like he's just sitting back in the rafters just watching and things go on. He actually adds something to this class.
Emery is in his last year in the Inspire program at Franklin College. It's a program connected to Earlywood Educational Services. These students work around campus, learn social skills, and go to classes, like the one Emery is in. Heverin says he challenges Emery inside the classroom and even while doing exercises in the weight room.
You feel that?
Mm-hmm.
One more. You can do it. Good. Rest.
The goal of Inspire is to make students more independent and prepare them for potential employment opportunities. And you can tell from Emery's interactions, high-fiving friends, grinning while he talks with his teacher, he truly enjoys it. But he admits it can be challenging. He was one of 10 students accepted to the program in 2016. His mother, Barb, says he was ready for the challenge, but she wasn't so sure.
And I thought, it's a big campus. Could he wander off and, get himself in some trouble? So it was a lot of soul searching, and finally we just took a deep breath and went with it. And he has just blossomed down here.
Barb says now the whole family calls Franklin home, particularly the football field, where Emery enjoys tailgates and games. Head coach Mike Leonard and his team have embraced the Inspire students and have helped give them a quote-unquote normal college experience.
By having these students out here at our practice, it's not only good for them to see our guys and see some normalcy of a college football practice, but it's great for our guys to have this group out here and cheer them on, even in a practice setting.
When Inspire first launched at Franklin in 2013, the school only accepted 5 students, and it didn't have the same kind of structure. The students, for example, didn't get to enroll in classes. The school now offers 40 courses and has implemented an internship program. They say it's truly become a campus-wide effort, and the whole college reaps the benefits, not just the Inspire students. Barb says, at times, Emery's path through academics was bumpy, but it led him here, graduation day.
The Big Man on Campus Award for Emery Himes for his Christmas school year.
And who better to send the graduates off on their next chapter in life than Coach Leonard?
Seeing you guys walk in was amazing.
During Leonard's speech, he tells the students to work hard and to remember the importance of teamwork in the future.
How about we all break it down with the word inspire? Because you guys have inspired us. Hopefully we've inspired you. So I'm going to say, Inspire on three, one, two, three, and then we'll all say inspire. Inspire on three, one, two, three.
Inspire!
Thank you very much.
Emery plans to continue working at his brother's pizza shop after graduation. He does the prep work, but his goal is to one day make the pizzas. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Lindsay Wright.
Next time we bring you another episode of this, which will be tomorrow, Lindsay Wright will introduce you to another Inspire graduate. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. The Northwest Indiana chapter of the Indiana Green Party hosted the first of two Voices for Peace rallies last Saturday in downtown Valparaiso, and they plan to hold a similar rally this coming Saturday at Wicker Park in Highland. We talked this morning with Sue Brown, who's the chairperson of the Northwest Indiana chapter, about last weekend's rally, and more about the man who was the main speaker at both events, George Wolfe.
We didn't have the attendance that we would have wished, but what was there was attentive and appreciative and lively and spirited, and so overall it was really great. And then of course we'll be repeating that. We'll have some as well as George Wolfe, of course.
Mm-hmm.
We'll be having some additional speakers, some the same, some different, this coming Saturday. So, and we look for more people to attend, just simply because Lake County is three times the size of Porter County, and we've gotten a lot of really welcoming reception from the groups in Lake County, so I'm looking for a better, attendance there. You know, that's about all I can say with only one rally behind us.
The first rally was held this past weekend on the north side of the Courthouse Square in downtown Valparaiso. And this coming Saturday, the rally is going to be held at the Veterans Memorial in Wicker Park in Highland, which is there off Ridge Road and Indianapolis Boulevard. That's a much bigger place, I imagine, and they say you'll have likely more people to attend.
They have been very welcoming and very cooperative. We had a really nice setup in Valparaiso, don't get me wrong.
Oh, yeah.
It was very nice, and we're really proud of the job that we did in staging and speakers at that first rally. But Wicker Park has been the staff, and, of course, the trustee, Frank Mervan, has been very welcoming and helpful, and so have many of the groups that we've talked to in the last few weeks, and so I'm looking for more attendance and even greater interest, let's put it that way, than we experienced.
Yeah. You mentioned that last weekend and again this coming weekend for the rallies, George Wolfe, who is the Indiana Green Party's candidate for Indiana Secretary of State, is the main speaker. He's, by the way, if the name is familiar, he is the past director of Ball State University's Center for Peace and Cultural Studies. Tell us, if you will, a little of what Mr. Wolfe had to say last week and what he may very well likely mention again this week.
Well, in a little more than 13 minutes, he pretty much covered the gamut. I mean, this man knows just basically trying to even get to a situation to where we can consider what we need to do to stop these wars, not only on an international basis, but within every individual.
Mm-hmm.
George has experienced peace from every angle of the question, and it begins with the individual and then moves on, to how do you combat the violence that is still out there as far as an international scene, national and international. So it was a very wide-ranging discussion that he put on the table, and he also spoke, of course, to the question of the Secretary of State's race and what he can do there to help people on a more local level, or state level, I guess I should say. Very well-rounded, very well-received.
Well, it sounds like he had some great comments to make, not only from his role as an Indiana State candidate, but also his role looking at the national and the international peace scene. So we'll no doubt hear some good comments from him this coming Saturday in Highland. And we also know, too, as you mentioned before, that maybe more speakers will be attending the rally that's going to happen at Wicker Park in Highland this weekend. So we may have even more comments as well along the same.
Absolutely. Yeah. Nick Egnetz, who has been, you know, campaigning for peace on the corner, right, catty corner from the Veterans Memorial there in Wicker Park.
Right.
He is going to be making a repeat performance, so to speak. And he undertook the question of how economics underlie many of our difficulties. And he's going to be, you know, doing a version of that as well, because we may have a few more speakers than we had last time, but Nick was kind enough to come again.
That's great.
And then we also have speaker from the Progressive Democrats of America, Calumet area. They could not send a speaker last week, so they have a woman who is going to be speaking this week. And then we also have a potential speaker. We're not sure. This remains tentative on his work schedule, but John Williams of USW Local 6787, who is the president of the Gary chapter of the A. Philip Redd Institute.
Mm-hmm.
And we will have another speaker, a young man who they are national, but they're not as well known. And he will be taking the place of Dave Turpin, who is a very well-known activist in Lake County. He gave a very spirited and moving speech last week, and we will have another speaker from that organization. Well, we have a couple that still remain tentative, like John, but it promises to be a very interesting, rally. And we welcome anyone and everyone, no matter what their position is, because we all are impacted by this, and we all need to become aware and understand the impact it has on families right here. Start, you know, paying more attention. That's what this is all about, is raising awareness.
These Voices for Peace rallies happening last weekend in Valparaiso, and the next one is coming up this coming Saturday from noon until 2 o'clock, and it's going to be at the Veterans Memorial, which is in Wicker Park in Highland. Sue Brown is with the Northwest Indiana Green Party chapter. And Sue, thank you very much for the update. We appreciate it very much, and we look forward to finding out more on how this coming Saturday's rally in Highland is going to turn out.
Thank you, Chris.
Some big changes coming to the Green Sense Farms in Porter County that you might be aware of. They're going to convert the farm basically to not only a farm, and we'll find out more about that in a moment, but also the fact that it's going to be a full-fledged research and development farm. And to tell us more about it, we have the founding farmer and CEO of Green Sense Farms, Robert Colangelo, with us. Robert, thanks for joining us here in Ridgely Speaking.
Thanks, Chris.
Well, for folks who are not familiar with Green Sense Farms over in the Portage area, tell us how the farm got started and the very interesting and rather innovative way that you're learning how to grow plants.
Well, we have a transformative way to grow produce indoors 365 days a year without the use of pesticides or GMOs. And we started our farm in 2012 here in Portage. And since then, we've learned a lot. One of the things we learned is that we're at the beginning of a brand new industry,
mm-hmm.
which requires lots of research and development to keep our technology current and to allow us to grow year-round and always be locally grown.
One of the interesting things that I've learned here about Green Sense Farms is the rather innovative way that you have come up with an indoor vertical growing system. Will you please explain how this really works and how it's become so productive in creating produce that people can enjoy year-round now?
Yes, the simple answer is we took horizontal farming, which has been done for thousands of years in a field farm outdoor, and we brought it inside and we stacked it. So we grow in hydroponic tubs where we interject the nutrient in the water into a plant's root system. So we give them exactly what they need, the right amount of fertilizer, the right amount of nutrient, the right amount of light, and also we control the environment so that the temperature and humidity and CO2 are perfect for the plants to go through the photosynthesis process. And by doing this, it allows us to grow year-round regardless of weather and outside climate.
That's, I guess it's not a unique concept, but the way that you're doing it certainly is. I know that you've been able to expand Green Sense Farms from just the operation in Portage here in Indiana to near South Bend, and you've got some other locations too. And I imagine it's all part and parcel of being able to find ways to grow plants, even though indoors, in different kinds of climates.
Yes. The trick is to create one environment that's good for the plants, and then be able to build these farms around the world regardless of the outside climate. So we are building a farm in Las Vegas where it's very hot and dry. We're also building a farm in French Polynesia where it's very hot and humid, and also one in South Bend where you get hot summers and very cold winters. So regardless of the outside temperature and climate, we can still grow consistently year-round because we control the indoor climate.
Now, Robert, what do you hope to take in making this conversion of just from the regular farm that you've set up here at the Green Sense Farms in Portage into a full-fledged research and development operation? What's it take to make the transition from one type of farm to basically another?
When we started this farm, we were doing both commercial production as well as doing R&D on systems and on the cultivars or the varieties of plants we can grow. By stopping our commercial production, we can now focus on testing new systems, such as different LED lights, both intensity and frequency. We can also test climate control systems that measure and monitor our temperature and our humidity. We could also test automated sensors and automation control devices, as well as automated packaging and conveyance equipment. On the other side, we're constantly improving our growing process, being able to get a higher density of plant per square foot and more plants per level, and turning our towers more often per month. So working on all those variables is what the center is going to be turned into. It was very difficult to grow for commercial production and sales and do R&D. We weren't doing either very well. Now we can have it very focused on R&D.
Yeah, it sounds like that you really have to devote space and time and effort from one or the other. And you can't, seemingly, as you've discovered, you can't do both at the same time, and you do justice to everything, I suppose. So it's probably well worth the time to convert over and be able to rely on the farms that you've set up, and in turn showing those as examples to the rest of the world that these are the ways that you can help grow plants indoors and vegetable produce indoors and do it economically as well as agronomically. So it works out very well, I would imagine, to do this. And then you can spend your time on research and development here in Portage.
Yes, and we're very lucky. We're working very closely with Purdue, Dr. Kerry Mitchell and Hazel Weinstein, who runs the horticultural college there. They have been tied into a NASA grant to be working on different aspects of growing for the Mars and the lunar grow modules. And also, the indoor vertical farming industry has grown a lot since we were one of the first early adopters of this technology. And last year, over $1.6 billion has been raised to fund indoor vertical farm startups. So wow. Our competitive advantage is being able to always develop the best growing technologies and then work on new cultivars that we can grow indoors at high densities. And so for us to remain competitive, we have to constantly raise technology, raise capital, and improve our technology.
Now, I know that since you worked so hard to be able to get the process started to begin with, you've been able to expand it from Portage into these other farms, including South Bend, and what you have set up that you're getting going on, I guess, in the South Pacific as well as in Las Vegas. You mentioned, too, that I guess you're trying to branch out around the world. There's some many other countries that would, I'm sure, be interested or have looked at this. And I also understand, too, from your staff have told me that you've had an opportunity to take this up to some folks who are very interested in this operation from overseas. In fact, you had a recent visitor to Green Sense Farms here in Portage, I understand, to talk to find out more about this and to talk with them about this.
Yes, our goal is to build a network of indoor vertical farms at our customer's location here in the U.S. and build a produce brand that's nationally known and locally grown through a network of farms that we build, own, and operate here in the USA. And then we license our technology to third parties to run farms that they own abroad. So we've had recent visitors from the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
Our farms, we can build high-yield farms on a small footprint that use a lot less water, a lot less land, and a lot less fertilizer than greenhouses or field farms. And with the Middle East tight on water, our technology really works well out there.
Well, it certainly sounds that way, that it's a great opportunity to expand this idea into some very workable operations in other countries, too. So it sounds like you've gotten the interest of people overseas. That's the important thing, that it gets to expand from beyond the United States to go around the world, to be sure. And the other thing I was going to ask for sure is, since you've been working on this expansion to the point that you're trying to convert the GreenSense Farms operation in Portage over to this full-time research and development facility, do you have any kind of timetable for this? Is it an ongoing process you're going through now?
We've already started the conversion. And the other thing is that we've noted that most of the R&D facilities are at universities, and they're very small scale.
Right.
So it's very hard to extrapolate the data that's generated from these academic laboratories to production use. So we found that we have a great opportunity to do contract R&D for third parties, both testing systems as well as testing new plants out there. So we've begun that process, and we're very happy with what we're able to do with our current facility.
Well, you know, it sounds like this is a great opportunity to kind of go full circle. You say that you got the assistance from the horticulturists at Purdue University on the West Lafayette campus to get started in this project, and now you're going to be able to do more R&D and maybe be able to turn some back over to Purdue. I imagine they'll welcome that as well, too.
Yes, Purdue is a great university. They recently launched the Foundry, which is really geared to entrepreneurs. And I think in the last 18 months, they've launched over 150 startups. So with Mitch Daniels, now president at Purdue University, has done just a great job at trying to commercialize technologies and foster entrepreneurialism. And I really want to give a big shout-out to our staff. We've got a great group of people here that are passionate and dedicated to figuring out how to grow more sustainably. And also, the state of Indiana has really made great strides, being an agricultural state, to try to make Indiana the hub for biopharmaceutical research. And that's really our end goal, is to look at cultivars that we can grow, especially botanicals, that can be converted into medicines or vaccines. Because we think growing indoors is very precision growing, and its highest and best use is for vegetables, but making medicines could not be another excellent application.
Mm-hmm. Well, Robert, consider the shout-out completed. Thank you very much for being with us to talk about it.
Well, thank you very much for having me on, and I commend you on getting great information through the Lakeshore Public Radio.
Robert Colangelo is the CEO, and he's the founding farmer of GreenSense Farms in Portage, Indiana. And the Portage Farm is now making a transition from just being a farm to a state-of-the-art research and development center on its indoor vertical growing systems and testing some new cultivars as well. In the U.S., around half of violent crimes reported to police go unsolved. The changing nature of crime and the technology used to solve it means that the job of a detective is always changing, too. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Drew Dodlin tells us about a new effort in Indiana to help detectives keep up.
What are you going to do with that? You going to leave that in the body bag, or are you going to remove that before you put it in the body bag?
A group of detectives have gathered around a parked car. They're trying to decide what to do with a piece of evidence attached to a dead body, portrayed by a mannequin, that's sitting in the passenger seat.
Well, we're going to photograph all that before we disturb any of it, obviously.
Right.
I would think that we would leave it there. Leave it there and have it all packaged up in one.
The scenario is part of Homicide School, a week-long series of lectures and workshops designed for detectives. It's the first time the school, hosted this year by Butler University, has been made available to all detectives in the region. Jeffrey Wager is the veteran detective guiding the group. Wager says a lot of detectives don't stay on the job for long, which he attributes to its high-stress, time-consuming nature. and he says that made him realize how important it is for long-timers to pass down their hard-earned knowledge.
One of the tricks I found over the years is when I wanted to know how long a car's been, when the last time the engine ran, I'd reach up in here and grab like where the motor mount is, because metal will hold the heat that's under there, but it won't get the heat from the sun because it's protected.
Some of the 63 detectives attending homicide school work in specialized units, but Wager says it's important, especially for small police departments that don't have room for a homicide unit, to prepare detectives for any situation.
That's stuff that, you know, a burglary detective might not see, so we're trying to pass along that information and just put it in their toolbox.
One of his students is Linda White. She's worked for over 10 years as a domestic violence detective in Indianapolis.
I don't have the desire to go to homicide, but I want to be able to use all the tools I can to solve my stuff, even though I have my suspect and victim.
White says a class on social media was especially useful, since the topic can be overwhelming to detectives who started long before it existed.
There's still people in my office who don't know how to use the social media.
White says she's been to a number of training schools throughout her career, many of them expensive and far away. She says there's a benefit to a localized effort like this, getting to learn from people who she knows. This is Marion County Prosecutor Terry Curry.
Many of the presenters are senior and some even retired homicide detectives, sort of legends in the local community.
The homicide school is the result of a collaboration between Curry's office and the Indianapolis Police Department. Curry says it's important for young detectives to learn fundamentals, things like the complex psychological challenge of getting victims and witnesses to cooperate. But he says rapidly evolving technology makes regular training vital for older detectives, too.
The tools that are available to us that, say, an older prosecutor like me, is something that we didn't have access to even a few years ago.
One of those tools is called NIBIN, a national database for bullets and cartridge cases found on a crime scene. NIBIN can help detectives connect one crime to another, evidence that could be the missing link in an unsolved case. But systems like NIBIN need to be learned. Detective Wager says, like anyone who hopes to do their job well, he's happy to keep learning.
There's nothing I like better than putting a puzzle together. And if I can use a new way to do something to make a part of that puzzle fit, that I enjoy that.
The plan is to start hosting homicide school twice a year. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Drew Dudlin.
And a time now for Eye on the Arts, and here is John Kane with South Shore Arts.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts are Veronica Napoli and Eric Roldan. Both of them, Roldan, and they, Veronica and Eric are the brains behind, or so I'm told, The Unwanted, a group of an artist group called The Unwanted. And you've been around for how long, Veronica?
Four years now. 4 years.
And is it, are you all graduates of the IUN art?
We are, yeah. Actually, the collective is a group of six artist friends who all met at the undergrad at Indiana University Northwest.
Mm-hmm.
We decided to stick together and put on unordinary art shows, or more like art parties. Like, that's what we like to call them.
Art parties. Well, we have art parties at the Art Center in Munster, but they're for like five-year-olds.
Yeah, we have them for all ages.
Okay. So you have an event that you've been doing. This will be, what, the fourth?
Yeah, this is our fourth year.
Yeah, this is number four, TO4, hashtag TO4. There you go, everybody. Mm-hmm. Yeah, our fourth one in a row. It's a live art and music fest designed for the community to come down and enjoy. It's over in downtown Hammond at the substation number 9 South Shore Arts Building. If you want to think of it as, like, what makes it unique, it's going to be fine art, but it's with a punk and rock and roll attitude attached to it.
And you do have music.
Oh, yeah. Fully loaded. Oh,
yes. Fully loaded.
Yeah.
With what?
So it's going to be a collective of collectives, basically. South Shore Arts is sharing the same parking lot with our neighbor Paul Henry's Art Gallery.
Mm-hmm.
We'll have music experts taking the stage inside the building.
So those bands are going to be referred to later in the interview. We got some nice little keywords for people to think about the bands that we have, but they're all HGS Music School affiliated.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. That's a school that's popular in Crown Point and in Highland.
Uh-huh.
So the musicians are teachers or students there, and they're coming on back,
that's
putting
great.
Their bands out in front for the audience.
Now, has that been the case in previous years?
No, previous years were mostly like bands we knew that we were friends with, we just like scouted out.
Uh-huh.
But this year, like, this is my second year with HGS Music.
Mm-hmm.
I work as a studio coordinator.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a lot of great friends I made there that
oh,
are
good.
Really good bands.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, really talented guys and girls.
Oh, that's great.
Mm-hmm.
You know, well, I love the fact that you're out networking in the community.
Oh, yeah. Oh, for sure, community.
You're really creating a scene.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I make scenes, but
we like your scenes.
You can
John.
Join our scene.
We like your scenes. Please do, John. That's a big goal. 2018 goal. Have John be part of Take It Outside somewhere.
I'm going to bring it outside this year. Please I do. Intend to bring it outside. So, is there food? I love food.
There will be food.
Yeah, there's going to be actually this year two options for food. We've got lunch and we got dessert covered. So that's
yes.
The
Hogs
first one,
and Dogs.
Yeah, go ahead.
Gourmet hot dog food truck, and we'll have dessert covered. Cuta's a cupcake traveling specialty bakery with both. Both will be on site in the parking lot.
So substation number 9 is in downtown Hammond, mm-hmm. off of Holman Avenue. Mm-hmm. It's a building that has peeling murals on the outside.
That's true.
That substation. This is substation's 20th anniversary too. In June of 2008, June of 1998 is when we opened it.
You know, I went there as a child.
Did you really?
I did.
Oh,
yeah.
You're a success story.
I know.
I could get a grant.
My mom,
about
yeah, it. Do it. My mom took me there, and I just loved it. I think my instructor had a bunch of tattoos or something, and I was just like, oh, I'm so inspired.
And now
look at my tattoo.
Here's the
Well, really, our goal.
I just love going there.
It's such a cute place.
It is. I
love
it.
People have no idea how neat it is inside. Yeah. And I forget, too, because I don't get there as often as I should. So we'd like to have pop-up events at Substation, and this is one. So you said that the art is with a punk edge.
Yeah.
Tell us, what does that mean? We have half a minute to talk about
it's like
the punk
edge. It's like a DIY style, a make-your-own-rules style, a make-a-lot-of-noise-in-people's-faces style.
Uh-huh.
But we're also fine artists that have that refinement attached to it. Right. So that's with the fine art and the music.
Because you're trained.
Yeah.
Right.
Everybody is.
Yeah. That's great. Mm-hmm. And I think you're going to be participating in our blockbuster this next year, the Indie Windy A Love Story. Ish is curating
Sweet.
It.
Sweet.
And, we got a huge grant from the National Endowment for the Arts.
Oh, that's
for
so
this
cool.
Thing. And he had talked about including your group in...
What?
In the show, yeah.
The
so
man.
We'll see.
This is the man.
Okay, we'll watch that unfold.
Yeah.
All right, so is there a charge?
No, it's a free event for the community. Why don't we talk about everything we have involved, actually?
We can't. We're
well, no,
we
can
run out of time.
Oh, we have?
Yep.
Yes.
Saturday, June 9th, 1 to 7 p.m.
We'll have a tattoo
9
shop or tattoo truck.
There's a tattoo truck there this year, talking about punk style.
Uh-huh.
Three bands,
uh-huh.
Two art galleries.
A bunch
the Decay Devils are going to be there.
Uh-huh.
A guy's going to be painting a surfboard live next to the band. His name's Casey King. He's a really cool guy.
Yeah.
Mythos Publications will be doing a live small zine workshop.
Yes.
Those guys are getting real popular.
Uh-huh.
And many, 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 many more things.
Many, many.
Oh, yeah.
Many well,
more.
Thank you. Thank you. And my mean producer is giving me the cut-off. So
thanks for having us.
For being here and telling us about Take It Outside. And thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
That's John Kane talking with Eric Rodan and Veronica Napoli. And you can hear this conversation and other Eye on the Arts conversations on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org. That's it for Regionally Speaking. For today, I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back with you tomorrow.